Welcome everybody to the Reflex Blues Show. I am Donovan Beery. I have with me my co-host Ben Luters. Ben, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you, Donovan?
Pretty good. And we have with us from the tubes of the internet all the way over towards San Francisco. And you guys have the internet over there, right?
Yeah, from time to time.
Okay, right. I hear they have it out there. We have with us Robert Bruner from Ammunition. And it's ammunitiongroup.com, is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
All right. Now, for those longtime listeners, they may remember Robert was on our show back when we were the B-Design cast. Maybe that's been like 5 years ago or so.
Don't look at me. I'm not one of those listeners. I've only been around a little while. So
You weren't even like out of like junior high 5 years ago.
Ben. I may have not have been born. Who knows?
Yeah. And since then, I would say the thing that Ammunition is probably best known for, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's probably a thing called Beats.
Beats by Dr. Dre has been a huge deal. It's done been crazy, phenomenally over the top kind of thing. So it's something that occupies a lot of our time right now.
And I realized at what level Beats had kind of infiltrated kind of the market when I was in Grand Island a few weeks ago, and I saw a high school kid there with his, I don't know if it was a Dell. Everything that's not an Apple looks like something else to me.
Yeah.
But where the Apple logo would be on a laptop, he had a giant Beats sticker just right there on front of it. And I was like, oh, I guess Beats have infiltrated that market of people knowing what they are.
Once it makes its way to Grand Island, Nebraska, you know it has severely infiltrated the system.
Yeah. So. Yeah, that's an indicator of market penetration, I suppose.
Now, when you guys started Beats, did you guys envision that it would go beyond Beats by Dre and become, what is it, Beats by Diddy? You have something with Lady Gaga, or did that just kind of happen organically?
A little of both. You know, when we started out, it was fairly simple. We were going to do a headphone. You know, I was remarking to someone the other day, I remember when, I mean, this was from the very beginning a partnership. It's not a typical business arrangement. And I remember thinking, I just hope I get, this is a cool project and I hope I get my money back. You know, was sort of what I was thinking at the time. Not that it would become a $700 million enterprise. But you know, originally it was just the product, right? And of course working with Dre, but even more so with Jimmy Iovine, who's the chairman of Interscope Geffen A&M Records, among other things, and a very well-known, highly respected music executive and producer. So he had always, had this idea that there'd be other artists involved, and we do products with other people. To what extent, it was never really understood, but we knew, okay, we're going to do some other stuff at some point. And yeah, so we did the Heartbeats product with Gaga, and then Diddy Beats with Diddy, and I think we're probably going to be doing less of that and more just focusing on the core Beats brand. That was something that we did and with some mild success, but I think everyone's just focused on making Beats as a standalone brand the best it can be right now.
Now, how was it that they came about finding Ammunition Group, or was it just a happen? You're hanging out with Dr. Dre one day,
yeah. Having drinks with Dre at the bar.
Yeah, it's great. I have this picture of me and Dre and Diddy that I keep on my iPhone at all time. It gives me an entree into nightclubs and makes my kids very proud. It actually started this when I was still at Pentagram, and there was a guy who sort of knew somebody who knew me, and he was actually a hedge fund trader, interestingly enough, and he had this idea of getting involved with artists to make products, and he actually was, I don't know why, was friends with Quincy Jones and a few other people, and somehow he'd gotten an introduction to Jimmy. And so he came and saw me and said, "Are you interested in going down and talking to these guys, sort of pitching them on developing some products?" And, I said, "Sure." It's, in the world of Silicon Valley high tech, it sounded pretty interesting and fun and exciting and different. So let's go do it. Long story short, through a sequence of events, that individual disappeared from the situation, and somehow the whole thing kind of landed in my lap to make it into something with Jimmy and Dre. So I've sort of been involved with it from day one.
Hmm. So it sounds like you've met a lot of very interesting people that make your children proud of you. Do you have any crazy stories with any of these musicians that you've met over the last few years?
Yeah. I mean, it could go on for probably an hour. I mean, the thing about working with, working in the music industry in general, and Jimmy in particular, it's never a dull moment, right? They're guy, brilliant guy, very, very nonlinear. I'm just sort of used to doing whatever they need to do right then, and then change, make a 180 degree turn whenever they feel like it, just that kind of thing. But absolutely, amazing insight and energy. But, the thing about it was almost every time I'd go down there for a review in his office, he'd invite in whoever would happen to be in the building, at the time. So whether it was, some of the music industry, whether it was, Diddy, Pharrell, Swizz Beatz, whether it was Oliver Stone, I've had meetings with Maria Shriver in the room. I mean, it's just like, always something. And it's actually, it's fun, but it's kind of dangerous, because someone, will say, express their opinion, could be totally off the mark, could be totally in left field, and somehow it gets listened to, right? And then you spend the next month or so trying to unwind that comment that someone made.
I cannot picture Oliver Stone throwing out conspiracies or off comment topics.
No, not at all. So that's been fun. I mean, one of the best stories was, there was a time early in the process where I got invited down for a meeting, and I didn't really know what it was about. I was just told I had something to do with color, bring your stuff along. And went down and showed up in the room, and I go into Jimmy's office, and there's like 12 people in there, and there's Dre and his people, and Pharrell and his people, and I think his mom was even there.
And, why not, right? You might as well just have his mom there.
And clearly the energy was, people were pissed, right? And there's something wrong. And we had made a change in the design, which was, largely for functional reasons. And I had sent down some, images of where we were going. And apparently, unknown to me, Dre didn't really like it. And so I could buy this room. I was going to be ambushed. And, politely trying to, argue to everybody with why this was the right way to go. And Jimmy was great with this stuff. He starts talking to me like I'm the only one in the room. I mean, like he and I are the only one in the room. And he says, Robert, I'm with you. I completely understand what you're saying, but I got to tell you, these guys know what's cool and they're always right. So here I am, like 40 something white guy, right? overruled that one. And
I love it.
And he said, you should listen to Pharrell. He's on the cover of like GQ. And Pharrell says, no, it's Esquire. And he goes, yeah, whatever.
Same difference.
I wish our clients, when they had opinions we didn't agree with, I wish they could back it up with being cool.
With being on the cover of Esquire, GQ. Or
yeah,
something.
Anything.
So, but in the end, it's all good. It's part of the culture of what the brand is. It's really about artists and their passions for music and bringing that out in the quality of the experience for people using the products. So it's all just part of the energy that goes into the stuff.
What was the most difficult part from a product design development when you initially were working with decided to start doing headphones?
Well, when we were doing the first studio headphone, we from the very beginning wanted to sort of re-architect it. When I looked at the vast majority of headphones that people wear on their heads, they tended to be really heavily articulated. That there's like the ear cups, then the ear cup swivel mechanism, then the band extension, then the headband, and all this sort of very functionally driven mechanical arrangements would really
This is the exact garbage headphones we are wearing right now. Yeah. We are hearing you, but not very well because we are wearing those.
Why do we not have Beats by Dre?
Maybe next time.
Well, yeah, but we knew how Jimmy really wanted to drive the brand, which is more like music street marketing techniques than typical marketing. It really needed to be iconic and very very a very, very simple, but sophisticated expression. So we decided to re-architect the way that the headband and the whole adjustment structure was put together to create this very sort of simple ear-to-ear single surface kind of approach. It was very clean, but yet had this shape, which is instantly identifiable. That was great, you know, in sketch rendering, rough model, you know, mechanically working all that out and making it reliable in mass production, all that stuff that you have to do as a designer was probably the biggest initial challenge to get it to work and work well.
I mean, we're graphic designers, so we understand like swatch books with like colors. Are there like, I mean, how do you find these materials? Do you locate them? Do you guys have like sources? I mean, do you have to invent these?
No, you know, it's typically finding the right material to perform what you want. The challenge with materials isn't necessarily finding them. It's getting them reliably available and produced in mass quantities, right? So it's one thing to find a little swatch of something that you think looks really cool, but to get it, you know, coming off an assembly line predictably and reliably in the quantities of hundreds of thousands or millions, that's where all the real work is. So that's what always makes it a challenge. But as far as, you know, the design, it's, you know, we have really great mechanical engineers we work with who, you know, we know what we want it to do. We know what we want, how we want it to perform. We know what we want it to look like, and they help us find the right materials and make sure they're able to be sourced and their characteristics are understood and all that kind of boring stuff that no one ever thinks about, but what makes a product work well, you know?
Robert, I got to ask, before you landed this job with Beats, were you familiar with these artists' music at all, with Dre's Records or Diddy or any of them?
Of course I'm familiar. I mean, I have a few Dr. Dre tracks on my iPod. And if you, I mean, I can't say I've, you know, hip hop is my genre. Say,
right.
You know,
that's what I was going for.
I mean, I'm born and raised on Led Zeppelin, and just, you know, sort of followed that path, you know, on through time as gone. So,
Led Zeppelin. Do we listen to Zeppelin around here,
Donovan? We have the entire Zeppelin collection on vinyl. Yeah, that's where that is our thing. Office.
So that's where I started, you know, and so I still, not that that's the only music I do listen to, but that's sort of always been my genre. But the No. They're really, you know, the thing about Dre is he is more than anything an audio perfectionist. I mean, he's happiest spending his time in the studio producing and engineering songs. It's what he loves to do. And that's where the whole genesis from the thing came from. It all started, you know, when I first went and saw them, and he said, well, what are we doing here? Why are you guys interested in this? And he said, you know what? People are not hearing my music. Right? You know, Dre would spend a year in the studio producing an album or a song, and it would go out and people would listen to it through crappy white earbuds. Right? You know, so all this detail, all this work, all this energy, people aren't hearing half of it. You know, and this was sort of the authentic proposition. He said, I want to change that. I want to do something that's designed to play the type of music I create well. And that's what started it all. Jimmy, being the consummate businessman, looked out to the market and said, there is no high performance audio brand for a younger audience. You know, it's what are you going to, you know, Bose is your dad's headphone. So there was nothing out there that provided really great sound for that younger audience. And then the whole idea became, we're going to build stuff that's tuned to Dre's sound profile. And, you know, we don't care what audiophiles think. It's not audiophile sound, it's club sound. And that's the sound that we want to recreate and reproduce well. And that's been, you know, the continuing mission and genesis behind everything, of making these really products that are tuned to the genre of music that play incredibly well. They look really great. And this sort of expression of Beats and what it means and the artists that are associated with it.
I love how it's created like a whole different section in the headphone market, like that didn't exist before and that now it's there. People are like, why was this never around before? So I think you guys have done a great job there.
Yeah, it's and now everyone's chasing us. It's just great. I went to the Consumer Electronics Show this January and walked around, and it's everyone's trying to look like Beats. Everyone has their own rap star. Everyone's trying to do the same thing, but it all rings like sort of foe or just following, because, you know, we managed to, you know, create something that's pretty powerful.
It's like they're trying to create the Beats by Bieber. That'll be next.
Beats by Bieber.
Yeah, well, I mean, the other thing about it that I always give a lot of credit to, again, is Jimmy and you know, his marketing prowess, he likes to, he said a few times that his quote I love to give out is, our marketing strategy is a lot of people owe me a lot of favors. And, you know, and that became, you know, so virtually every artist that he knows, every athlete, and again, anybody that comes into the building becomes associated with Beats, you know, and wears the products and allows themselves to be photographed wearing the products. And, you know, I finally got it that, you know, what he really is good at is making things bigger than we are, right? So it's really the idea of Beats is, you know, takes on this sort of feeling of a movement that people want to be part of because it's bigger than they are. And that thing like your kid's plastering the sticker on his Dell laptop, you know, he wants to be part of that thing, right? And Jimmy's a master at doing that.
Well, I will say it looked a lot better than whatever Dell logo or whatever that he was covering up with it. So props to that. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be right back with Robert Bruner. All right, welcome back, Robert Bruner with Ammunition, ammunitiongroup.com. You guys have also been responsible not only with headphones, but now reading. So you got our ears, now you're working on our eyes. Is that how it worked with the Barnes & Noble Nook, which you have to buy this at a bookstore in your books? I don't even remember what those are.
We've been involved with Barnes & Noble from day one with the creation of Nook, and it's been another huge part of our work here at Ammunition and developing the line of products.
The Nook is basically, was that, I forgot, did that follow the Kindle or is it created at the same time as the Kindle?
No,
the Kindle's kind of the competitor in this market,
yeah,
isn't it?
You know, it is definitely. I mean, it follows the Kindle. I worked on the original Kindle, you know, when the Lab 126, which is the division of Amazon that makes the product, started. And, you know, and so I'm a rare pioneer in the ebook space, I guess.
Worked on the Kindle, and then you went and worked on the Nook. I just can't even believe this.
Well, I've been, you know, Amazon built its own team and brought all the work inside, and so I hadn't been involved in Kindle for a few years. And Barnes & Noble was actually seriously behind Amazon. They had, you know, like a lot of companies like this, were a bit protective of their book retailing, and for a variety of reasons, took them a couple years to figure out they needed to be in the electronic reading space. You know, so I got a call from Steve Reggio, who was at that time the CEO of Barnes & Noble, went out and talked to him a bit about what they needed to do. And, you know, a few months later, they engaged us to help them. And, you know, in less than a year, we shipped the first Nook, which is, you know, an incredible effort for a company that never actually made anything other than a book jacket, you know, before that, to deliver a handheld wireless content delivery platform in a year was a pretty incredible effort. But, you know, the thing to their credit, you know, from the very beginning, you know, remember one of the first meetings we were talking about the product, and I said, you know, the thing is that when you look at the Kindle, you know, books don't have buttons, you know, right? But the Kindle at the time, you know, before touch came to play, was, you know, had a QWERTY keyboard, had control paddles, function buttons, all this, you know, very sort of productivity kind of metaphor. And, you know, Barnes & Noble was always about reading and authors and sort of, you know, the patronage of literacy. And, you know, I really wanted to bring that energy into the product. So we said from the very beginning, we're going to build the best possible reading experience. You know, and Amazon, knowing from working with them and just in general, I mean, they're really, Amazon's culture is about commerce, right? And in many ways, you know, the Kindle is the tail end of the Kindle store. Where we just looked at it differently, we just have to build the best possible digital reading experience. And that's what's going to drive success for Barnes & Noble, and just to always do that from the physical design, interaction design, the technology. It's always about that reading experience. And they've done incredibly well. And, you know, Amazon still dominates the market, but I think in e-reading, Barnes & Noble is number two. If you broaden it to be tablets, I think they're number five. I mean, just really an incredible accomplishment for a company that wasn't even a technology company, you know, 3 years ago, 4 years ago. So
when you when you work with a product like this that involves something such as like a digital store, how much involved do you have to be with the software developing team? Or is that a different group, or do you just work kind of together, or is it kind of like you're just stuck with what they create?
Well, initially in the first product, we had a lot of interaction with them to really sort of defining the architecture of how the product would behave. And so we were very much part of figuring out the application layer and how it behaved and how the store would operate, how you'd find content, download content, open it, do all that. So that the first product was very engaged. As time goes on, as software kind of becomes very platform-like and sort of evolves more slowly. And ironically, the hardware evolves more quickly. So we tend to now, as we do a new product, we check in terms of where things are going from the interaction point of view, from the software perspective, see what we can do to integrate the hardware better. But there's sort of two things moving in a parallel line in the same direction.
Robert, I've got a question for you. I was preparing for the show yesterday, visiting the website, ammunitiongroup.com, and I was struck by this toilet on that website. And I want you to explain to our listeners, first of all, everybody go and check this out. It's Kohler makes this toilet.
Yeah, there's like photos of just people standing around what appears in a living room in a loft around this toilet hanging
it's
out.
It's this beautiful white box, almost like a white Jawa sandcrawler. And it has a remote control, different flush cycles, and somehow you made a very sexy toilet. How did you do it? Why and was it successful?
Well,
and people just stand around it at parties.
Yeah, that's exactly the idea. No, I mean, first of all, we didn't actually design the toilet. We do a lot of work with Kohler on largely development of communication, brand, and launch programs. We helped them launch products. So we helped launch the Numi toilet and helped name it and brand it, package, communication strategy, all that stuff. My partner Brett Wickens worked on that, and I really just got a kick out of the whole idea. It's a $6,000 toilet, right? And it does everything.
I'm not getting one. That's what you're saying.
but the idea of sort of treating it as this sort of object of fascination, and you talked about the photographs, shot in amazing architectural masterpieces with beautiful people standing nearby. And it was just, in a way, it was a bit fun, almost poking fun at it, but in a very smart way, right? Just saying, look, this thing is an object you're going to put in your living room. So, I got a kick out. It was a really successful campaign. It became part of their advertising, and they, it's really what we've been working with Kohler is big launching things. I mean, before we started working with them, they never launched products. They just showed up in their catalog. So we've been with a third or fourth iteation of new products, of figuring them how to go out and communicate to the world and gain some attention for it. So, but it's fun stuff. Yeah, that thing, I'll probably get in trouble for saying this, but it was codenamed in the office, the iPoop.
The iPoop. So follow-up question, do you have one?
No, I do not have one. No, I don't.
Second follow-up question.
Last thing I want to have to do is to have to reboot my toilet. It's already gotten bad enough,
You got to call in a plumber, an electrician, and an IT guy if it goes bad.
Yeah, exactly.
Very nice. That did not make the ad or the launch, probably.
No.
But I'm sure it doesn't go bad for that good of a toilet. Who knows?
Yeah.
We'll try one out.
So I was never that fond of a touchscreen remote associated with the toilet. Somehow it's kind of icky, But anyway,
that was the first thing that came to my mind, but I'm sure you guys thought all that through. So.
All right, we're going to take one final break, and then we'll be back in just a minute. All right, we want to kind of wrap this show up. I want to kind of get how do you see companies using design in the future, and how should companies be using design and designers?
That's a really great question, because I think I've seen rapid change in the last 10 years, and especially the last five, of how design is viewed in the business community. It's interesting. When I talk to clients and they come in, I say, well, we're always seeking our partnerships, right? Because, it's where we do our best work is when we're really, deeply integrated into the business proposition. We really get it. We're part of it. And we're viewed as a partner, not, a vendor, right? And those are the things that are successful. And ironically, even the ones when it goes the other extreme and we're sort of in a situation where we have almost too much control, right? Where we're driving our own personal agenda higher than the client's business agenda because of the situation. That's not necessarily our best work either. It's always when we're sort of really integrated. And the things like Beats and Fuego and a few other enterprises we have where we're integrated literally into those businesses, do our best work. And the interesting thing about it I found was when you are in that situation in a partnership, when you're essentially putting your money in the situation too, more or less, people listen to you more, right? They really understand that you're at risk as well, so you're integrating that. So, to me, that's the future of design, is really being truly tightly integrated into the success and failure of things. And more and more, the good companies are understanding that what design is really their interface plane to the outside world, right? So that's how they communicate with people, whether it's literally through the kind of work you guys do or subtly through the way people touch and feel something I've done. That's how you create relationships with people, and so the good ones get that. Companies like Apple always have, but more and more companies are understanding that how they're going to be successful is working with designers in a partnership to really define that communication plane with the rest of the world and make it really great and make it authentic and make it work for their business. And so that's been a foundation of our model here at our company, and more and more, the people that we're working with get that and are supporting it.
No, I think that's great advice. I know probably people will ask you this, and I think we probably have to, since Steve Jobs has passed away, do you have any stories on Steve Jobs? I know you didn't really overlap when you were at Apple too much with him, but.
Well, yeah. I mean, I get interviewed a lot about Steve because no one at Apple will talk. And I work with him. It's a lot of what's going to happen to Apple, blah, blah, blah. My favorite one actually has to do with Beats. Jimmy Veen and Steve were friends, and Jimmy would call Steve up to ask him what should I do, right? What whether it's a business issue, technology, whatever. And apparently Jimmy told me that when he showed Steve the studio headphone and said, your former chief designer Robert Bruner did it, Steve said this comment to Jimmy, which was basically paraphrasing a bit, but, oh yeah, Robert, he didn't do too badly. I think it's like a super compliment, right? I thought that was coming out of, I wish I'd heard it directly, because coming out of Steve Jobs' mouth, saying you didn't do too badly is like,
yeah, probably as well have just given you a medal.
So anyway,
I'll take that any day. Great.
So anyway, I think it'd be very interesting to watch Apple the next few years and see what happens. Cause that there has to be an impact, not having, your chief, experience officer who really has his hands in everything, not there. It'll create vacuums and they'll be filled somehow. I see the company obviously continue to be hugely successful, but it'll just be interesting to see how that evolves.
Yeah. I mean, it can't not affect it, but they still have a lot of smart people over there.
Absolutely. Very talented. And the culture is one of, it always has been, of doing great stuff. And they inherently understand how to do that.
No, well, we really appreciate your time. And hopefully we'll run into you soon.
All right. Great, guys. It's been a pleasure.
All right. Thank you. For all of our listeners, thank you for listening. You can catch up, follow, leave comments, 36point.com.